This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Over the past few weeks, we've been talking a lot about the liberal arts and whether a liberal arts education is still a valid tool in today's job market. And for the most part, the answer has been either a guarded or resounding yes. But not all liberal arts programs are created equal.
4 years ago, the faculty was in the midst of a revolution, really, thinking about liberal arts education in a completely new way.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about Connecticut College and their new program called Connections. We'll also learn how some states are not doing enough to protect student-athletes, and we'll spend an academic minute with lazy kids. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. So, over the past few weeks, I think we've determined that getting a liberal arts degree is not a one-way ticket to a life in the fast food industry. But some institutions are adapting and modernizing their programs. Last year, Connecticut College implemented a new program called Connections, which the college says will better prepare students for life in the 21st century. Here to talk about Connections is Dr. Catherine Bergeron, the president of Connecticut College. We started to talk about the program and ended up going down a few other roads. I started by asking her about the situation at the college when she got there close to 4 years ago.
Well, Connecticut College is a small liberal arts college in New London, Connecticut that has about 1,800 students. And when I arrived 4 years ago, the faculty was in the midst of a revolution, really, thinking about liberal arts education in a completely new way. This was a topic that was very exciting to me, someone who cares a lot about how we think about educating our students for the 21st century. We have actually made a major change in thinking about the liberal arts in a new way at this college.
We've been speaking over the past few weeks about liberal arts and its importance and its significance in today's workplace. Is this still something that people can use to build a career?
Oh, absolutely. But I maybe should step back a little bit and think about what a liberal arts education is and what it's for. You know, American higher education has always placed an emphasis on broad-based inquiry, right? You might say on diversifying your intellectual portfolio. So, you know, what we call a liberal education or a liberal arts education has traditionally encompassed the study of knowledges across the disciplines of the humanities and the physical and biological sciences and the social sciences and the arts. You know, designed to be an education for life, to prepare you not just to make a living, but in a sense, to have a life worth living. And this had even a broader purpose, really, because a liberal education historically has always been about preparing citizens for leadership in a democratic society, right? If you have government by the people, you need citizens who are willing and able to lead, and the view has always been that to be successful, those citizens need an education that will develop the full range of their intellectual and social and imaginative capacities. And I'm talking about not just verbal and analytical skills, but all kinds of personal, enduring traits that animate your life and give it substance. You know, curiosity or creativity or perspective or tolerance, empathy, you know, courage, the ability to deal with the unknown. So, you know, when people talk about critical thinking, I think that's what it means. These higher order skills that produce a nimbleness or a flexibility of mind that allows us to learn how to learn under changing circumstances. And that kind of adaptive capacity has become really even more necessary in today's global economy, which is really why the liberal arts have become not less but more important in the 21st century.
And it sounds, by your description, you're not instilling these things. You're just helping them blossom in a person who already has these qualities.
Well, all human beings have innate qualities of excellence. And so, yes, that's what we want to do in American higher education, is actually to bring out the best of every person, to allow each person to reach his or her full potential.
I mean, well, you talked about courage, and I'm sorry, I'm a scaredy cat, and you're never going to teach me courage.
No, courage is the ability to deal with the unknown, and actually it means that you learn these methods of thinking that allow you to approach something that you know nothing about and then to begin to, I don't know, break it down to find a way into something that you know nothing about. That does take courage.
Okay. Connections. That seems to be where your college has taken this liberal arts education. Talk about the connections system.
Connections is Connecticut College's reinvention of the liberal arts. So it's a new kind of approach that really allows students to integrate their interests along a meaningful educational pathway that will carry them through college and also into a productive life beyond college, right? So through Connections, our students can orchestrate their education with the help of a team of advisors, and they can learn for life beyond college by tackling real-world problems in a collaborative setting, and they can, as we like to say, put the world together in new ways by combining interdisciplinary study and a relevant internship and a world language and a whole interconnected outlook. So we do think of it as the new liberal arts for our interconnected world.
And you do call it interdisciplinary scholarship. How do these disciplines work with each other?
I think that the way students learn the best is by beginning to see the connections, not just between the kinds of disciplines that they encounter in their broad-based studies, but also in all the kinds of work that they do, right? You know, our students are passionate and they want to change the world, but the world's problems, you know, can't be solved through just one way of thinking or knowing or one way of working. And so Connections is really asking every student to start thinking about solutions differently by connecting that passion and conviction to every part of their college experience, right, to the work that they're doing in courses and research, but also the work that they're doing in jobs and in the community and across the globe and ultimately in their lives beyond college and their careers.
So who came together to create this discipline? Was it just the faculty getting together? You just got there so in 2014, so I'm sure you were involved. Who got together and put this together?
Well, a curriculum is never changed by members of the administration. It does require a committed faculty. And so it was very much a faculty-driven effort to think about what we could do building on our strengths as a school with a kind of porous disciplinary structure, right, one where people were really collaborating across their silos, thinking about that strength and what we could do to take that to a new level and make it available to every student. You know, it was a process of first identifying what those principles were that we wanted to ensure were being supported in this new environment, and then what were the structures and the shape that it would take over 4 years. So, you know, I can tell you a little bit about how it works. You know, in the first year now, students will take some specially engineered courses and work with a team of advisors that then set them on their journey. In the sophomore year, they choose a major, as they always did, but we also ask them to start out on what we're calling a pathway. And the pathway really replaces that old checklist of general education requirements that's very typical in American higher education. The pathway is really a set of interdisciplinary courses and other experiences that are organized around a central theme. So we have a pathway in entrepreneurship and one now in peace and conflict, a pathway in sustainability, one in global capitalism, along those lines, right? Mm-hmm. This is a place where students will develop the question that they have and explore that over 5 semesters. And then in the junior year, they develop that question further with more coursework in many different disciplines, as well as in internships and research in the local community and abroad. And then in the senior year, they bring it all together in an integrative project. So it's a very compelling package with a real purpose, because we really want all of our students, as we like to say, to put the liberal arts into action in their own unique ways.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Catherine Bergeron, the president of Connecticut College, continues with a look at how this effort tries to separate Connecticut College from other institutions. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Catherine Bergeron, the president of Connecticut College in New London, Connecticut. We're talking about the college's new way of teaching the liberal arts called Connections. Earlier, she called her school a small liberal arts institution, so I pointed out that there are a lot of those in the Northeast. How does this program make her college unique?
Well, I think that the way students learn at every school is distinctive. Each school has its own mark. And what Connecticut College has been trying to do is really define the nature of learning in a new way. So, yes, I think the pathway is going to make Connecticut College education slightly different from the approach to the liberal arts that you find at other places. And I think one of the things is that it's not a special program that's for a select few. It's not an honors program. It really is for every single student, to maximize the benefit for every single student.
So this has been in effect for a few years. You obviously haven't gone 4 years now, so you haven't seen this from beginning to end yet, have you?
No, the class of 2021, which is this year's entering class, will be just the second group of students embarking on this approach. However, the college has for a couple of decades supported some centers for interdisciplinary scholarship, centers in the environment and international studies and arts and technology and community action and public policy. So these were really the prototypes for the pathways. They still exist. And so we actually have a lot of evidence for how successful this model has been. Students who went through these programs, we called them certificate programs, that they entered in their sophomore year, showed themselves to have more success, greater affinity for their studies, greater post-baccalaureate success, and a greater interest in promoting this kind of education in their lives beyond college. So we actually, in a way, did the market research. We did the testing over a number of years, and we see that the possibilities for all of the students who are entering in this program to be very positive.
Well, I'll ask you for 2 points of view on this. How is the faculty reacting to the new way of doing things, and how are the students reacting?
Well, I would say that the faculty has been behind this in a remarkable way, in a way that's really quite inspiring. And part of it is because it's a lot of work to change something. And so it's one thing to dream it, it's another thing to do it. And I think it's been a real mark of the excellence of our faculty to see how they are embracing this change and thinking about all the ways that it redefines their relationships with each other in the educational environment, especially as they put these pathways together, where we have about 8 of them now. I think the goal is to have 12 in addition to the programs in our interdisciplinary centers. And that kind of creativity is really galvanizing. The students, I think it's early days to be able to report on their success, but I think from what I observed in just our first-year class last year, there's a lot of excitement about the way they're being unleashed to discover what interests them the most. You know, one of the things we want them to develop in that sophomore year is really a question for themselves. What is it that makes you tick? What are the questions that interest you the most? How do you see yourself contributing to the world? And as you develop that question, you create a frame for your studies that really help you to learn more. I could share one success story that comes from someone who just recently graduated from one of our centers that might be a useful illustration.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about a young woman named Grace Juster, and I would say she effectively piloted this new curriculum, and she really used Khan's open interdisciplinary environment to combine her interest in art and technology. So she came to the college with no evident interest in math, but by coming into contact with some of our outstanding teachers and by getting excellent advising, she ended up majoring in computer science together with visual art, which was her real passion. She also completed this certificate program that we have in our Center for Arts and Technology, which, as I said, was one of the precursors to our new pathways. And so in the process, she became fascinated by 3D printing, and she ended up building her own printer for one of her projects. And this got her into a competitive internship at FastBot, which is a company that produces these things and programs them. She did this at the end of her junior year. She put all that newfound knowledge into action, did an integrative senior project, and now, 1 year after graduation, she is a digital resource manager at Grey Group, which is one of the world's top marketing and advertising firms. So you could see the path taking her to something that is now a really creative outcome of this education, integrative education.
Do you feel there may be eyes over your shoulder, other colleges and institutions looking at the way that you are doing this and saying, maybe we'll give this a shot?
Well, I think if so, that would be great because, you know, I was thinking about this. The 20th century was all about the separation of the disciplines. You know, the 21st century is really about their reintegration. You know, this has been spawned by technology and the way information is available to us in quantities unlike we've known before. So now there's now a new way of thinking about how we put all of this together. I think people are going to have to adapt their ways of teaching to the new realities of our society and of the way we come about knowledge. And I hope that we become a model.
So it's a new program, but look ahead. Where do you see this going or adapting in the future?
Well, one of the things that we're doing, as I said, are we're trying to develop a broad range of pathways that will reflect the range of interests that our students might have. And so one of the pathways that is currently in development, in addition to those that I mentioned, is a pathway in urban education, for example. And there's another one in development on creativity. So these are concepts or themes that can be explored from many, many different disciplinary perspectives. The point is to create a new way of thinking about how you make your way through 4 years.
Dr. Catherine Bergeron is the president of Connecticut College in New London, Connecticut. You can learn more about the Connections program at conncoll.edu. That's conncoll. .edu/connections. And we'll throw a link to that on the T-Book page at wamc.org. The University of Connecticut's Corey Stringer Institute has released a national study on high school sports safety. It lays out what states are or are not doing to protect athletes from concussions, heat stroke, and sudden cardiac arrest. The best of our knowledge is J.D. Allen reports.
When it comes to pro athletes, the data isn't as murky as it was even a decade ago. Concussions and brain injury have been found in alarming numbers in the NFL. Concerns are now reaching the high school level, and studies have concluded that even one blow to the head could result in a lifelong injury. Since 2009, all 50 states have passed laws that require athletes, coaches, and parents to go through some kind of concussion training. Many policies include the mandatory removal of athletes from a game or practice until they receive medical clearance to return, especially if a head injury is suspected. UConn's Corey Stringer Institute found that policies vary from state to state and that some states are not doing enough to protect athletes from concussions, as well as other life-threatening injuries like heat stroke and sudden cardiac arrest. The institute is named for the late NFL player who died from complications of heat stroke during a Vikings practice in 2001.
So we developed a grading rubric that assessed current best practices for not only preventing, but also managing those leading causes of death.
University of North Carolina at Greensboro Professor William Adams co-led the study. The top five states are Kentucky, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and South Dakota, with North Carolina ranked at number one. In the Northeast, New York came in at number 12, Pennsylvania at 22, Maine 26, Rhode Island 27, Vermont 34, Connecticut at 38, and New Hampshire 44. Colorado was last. Adams said Massachusetts ranked high because it has appropriate medical coverage and emergency preparedness.
Primarily having access to an AED on-site, appropriate training for coaches and any other personnel interacting with their athletics program. They also had policies related to exertional heat strokes, such as phasing in of activity during preseason practices to improve one's heat tolerance to exercise in hot conditions. They also had policies surrounding environmental monitoring, having policies related to traumatic head injuries.
UConn study found that in the past 30 years, there have been 735 deaths and 626 more of what Adams calls catastrophic injuries related to high school sports, and an increase of 60% over the last decade, according to the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention. Massachusetts parents, coaches, and students are required to take the National Federation of State High School Associations concussion course, a cognitive test during the preseason to provide a baseline of data to be used if a player suffers a head injury later on.
And then they have that in terms of gauging how soon the player can come back.
Adams said states score higher for having return to play strategies and for having athletic trainers on site to carry out emergency action plans and medical care.
Ensuring everyone's on the same page to make sure that the athletes are cared for appropriately.
States were notified of their ranking in the study and were able to review scores with feedback.
And that report from the best of our knowledge is J.D. Allen. If you think today's kids don't get out and play enough, you're right. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Today's kids are not getting enough physical activity. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Bruce Lee, associate professor of international health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, explores why this is something everyone should be paying attention to.
These days, kids just aren't getting enough physical activity. Less than one-third of children in the United States aren't even meeting the minimum requirements for physical activity as outlined by the Sports and Fitness Industry Association. That's 25 minutes of vigorous physical activity 3 times a week. Should you care, even if you don't have kids or GASP don't even like kids? Yes, absolutely. Because it is costing you and everyone else money. Billions. Our recent study showed that just increasing the proportion of children who meet the minimum SFIA standards from less than a third to 50% could decrease the number of obese and overweight youth by 4.18%, averting $8.1 billion in direct medical costs and $13.8 billion in lost productivity. Why? Physical inactivity can lead to weight issues, which can lead to health problems such as diabetes, heart disease, strokes, and cancer. Health problems, in turn, can lead to medical costs and lost productivity. Medical costs then can lead to insurance costs. Insurance costs lead to higher premiums for everyone. Lost productivity leads to business losses. Business losses hurts the economy. Hurting the economy hurts all of us. Why aren't kids more physically active? Broken systems. Broken social systems leading to sedentary lives. Broken school systems with physical education classes being cut. Broken environmental systems without enough parks, playgrounds, and safe walking paths. The list of broken systems goes on and on. So this is everyone's problem, because if our country doesn't change, it's going to cost everyone change. A lot of change.
That was Bruce Lee of Johns Hopkins University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.